Perhaps you're getting used to this by now, how Matthew's gospel is a symbol crashing over and over and over again. If you're looking for subtlety or mildness, you'll have to look somewhere else. Because Matthew is a foghorn with 1,000 trumpets blasting in the background. A few weeks ago, I was wringing my hands over one of the parables I'd be preaching on Sunday. The person I was talking to about my consternation with Matthew's way of being in the world quipped, "If I'm honest, if Jesus went around saying things like this, I'd probably want to kill him too." Jesus does seem intent on provoking a rather nasty encounter with the rulers of the day. It's Passover in Jerusalem. And while the Roman authorities generally left the city open and under the leadership of the temple priests, Passover was the time when the guards moved in. Can you guess why? Do you remember what the story of Passover is about? It's the retelling of God's chosen people, Israel, freed from the horrific oppression of Gentile overlords who make their life miserable, restrict their worship, and oppress them at every turn. Sound familiar? It was not lost on either the Jews or the Romans how similar that story sounded to what was happening in their own day. And it was not lost on the revolutionaries and would-be messiahs of the first century who were known to plan insurrections around Passover. Jerusalem is a powder keg at Passover, and Jesus tosses in a match. Jesus rides into Jerusalem during Passover. He rides in giving clear instructions on the way to construct this scene to fulfill Old Testament prophecies about the Messiah. And then goes into the temple and tears it up, throwing out money changers and dove sellers. But that's not all. Have you all enjoyed the parables we've heard over the last 6 weeks of Lent? These intense stories about wealth being uprooted and the hell of people who live in the failure to care for their neighbors. All those stories that riled us up, all those stories are told after Jesus enters Jerusalem. So take everything you've heard for the past 5 Sundays and imagine it happening after the story we just reenacted here. There's an expression that sums up what's happening: poking a bear. You don't want to wake up a bear by poking it because something bad will happen to you and to everyone else around you. But that's where we're at. The scene of a triumphant king entering occupied Jerusalem, it spits in the face of Herod Antipas. These parables comparing kings to maniacal tyrants, they kick dirt at Caesar. Now I want you to imagine that your job is to keep people in your community safe and secure. Imagine your job is to keep your religious community walking a tightrope of survival. Imagine seeing horrific political executions and bloody overthrown rebellions. Imagine all of that is on your shoulders. And if you can get that feeling of fear under your skin, you'll have a good sense of what's behind the angry response from the scribes and the chief priest who hear even children crying out, "Hosanna in the highest." Do you hear what they're saying? "Do you?" they ask Jesus. "They are going to kill us. Everything you love will be lost. Everything we have will be ruined. The crowd is causing a riot." I have a soft spot for the scribes and chief priests in Jesus' created predicament. Throughout much of the history of the church, Jews in these stories have been betrayed as an other, an enemy. As the split between Judaism and Christianity widens over the centuries, the church began to say that it was the Jews and the temple leaders who crucified Jesus. They became the enemy of the church. I will not repeat to you the vile tropes about Jews that crop up in the theologians like Martin Luther. That anti-Semitism eventually turns deadly, creating persecutions and expulsions of Jews around the world. It is lazy and poor biblical reading to see the Jewish leaders of the temple as enemies in the story. Instead, they find themselves in the place of many religious leaders, working hard to figure out how to stay alive during terrible times, how to protect the people under their care. It wasn't long after Akiel Dinkins was killed by Raleigh police in Southeast Raleigh that the city officials called together a room full of pastors. Did you know that? They were asking them to keep the peace, to calm people down, to keep the streets from erupting in protest or property destruction. This is a scene that plays out around the country in times of unrest. Religious leaders are called in as trusted arbiters for a certain kind of peace. It's that room with religious leaders who've been called to peace that I imagine when I hear this cry from the religious leaders of ancient Palestine. They are doing the best they can to hold things together. Can't Jesus see that? The frustration that boils over in this angry response to Jesus, it doesn't reveal something about Jews. It reveals something about us. It reveals something about every person who puts their faith in the structures of power for fear that it might what might happen if those structures give way. It isn't unusual to be a part, for the church to be a part of the maintenance project where you work with what you've been given. After so many deaths, so much destruction, it's difficult to have the imagination for anything other than failure and bloodshed. Jesus shatters this foundational assumption of where we place our security, of where we go in times of struggle and violence. On April 3rd, 1968, a series of nonviolent direct actions caused a shudder through the city of Birmingham, Alabama. These were efforts coordinated by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the Alabama Christian Movement for Human Rights. A week after sit-ins and boycotts erupted through Birmingham during Holy Week, a judge passed a legal injunction forbidding demonstrating, picketing, or protest. Of course, the actions continued. The movement leaders were arrested and imprisoned at the Birmingham jail. Among them were Fred Shuttlesworth, Frank Abernathy, and a young preacher named Martin Luther King. A couple days later, a group of white clergymen offered a response to the nonviolent demonstrations in a letter they wrote to their local newspaper. Their op-ed was titled, "An Appeal for Law and Order and Common Sense." Fearing the potential for violence or disruption, they appealed to black leaders to stop breaking the law. Here's what they wrote. "We believe this kind of facing of issues can best be accomplished by citizens of our own metropolitan area, white and Negro, meeting with their knowledge and experience of the local situation. All of us need to face that responsibility and find proper channels for its accomplishment." Proper channels. The timing isn't right. We have laws here for a reason. There are better ways. We are afraid of what will happen to the things that we love. We're afraid for our people. We are afraid for the safety of our city. And from a cell in the Birmingham jail, King wrote back. This is what he wondered, penning his letter from the floor of a prison cell. "Is organized religion too inextricably bound to the status quo to save our nation and the world? Perhaps I must turn my faith to the inner spiritual church, the church within the church, as the true ecclesia in the hope of the world. But then he goes on to say this: I'm thankful to God that some noble souls from the ranks of organized religion have broken loose from the paralyzing chains of conformity and joined us as active partners in the struggle for freedom. They have left their secure congregations and walked the streets of Albany, Georgia with us. They have gone down the highways of the South on torturous freedom rides. And yes, they have gone to jail with us. Some have been dismissed by their churches, have lost the support of their bishops and fellow ministers, but they have acted in the faith that right defeated is stronger than evil triumphant. Their witness has been spiritual salt that has preserved the true meaning of the gospel in troubled times. They have carved a tunnel of hope, through the dark mountain of disappointment. I hope the church as a whole will meet the challenge in this decisive hour. Over and over, the white church feared the disruption of systems that kept in place the ways it made it possible for a certain kind of peace to work out within them and among them. And on Palm Sunday, I'm reminded that Jesus will have none of that. Palm Sunday brings danger, the danger of a riot. Standing before the parables of Matthew for the past 6 weeks, I hope that we've learned together this: Jesus is not an ethics program. He doesn't offer universal teachings on morality or civics or empathy. If we are to follow this Jesus of Matthew, we will find ourselves in the path of the one who causes the very systems and institutions in whom we put our trust to crumble. And we will walk through the ruins with him. When he entered Jerusalem, the whole city was in turmoil. The city quaked. This is the Greek word from which we get the word seismic, a word that names the shifting of the very tectonic plates below the earth, the world's very foundation. Matthew will use this word three different times: at the entry into Jerusalem, at Jesus' death on the cross, and on Easter morning when the women come to the empty tomb. The gospel of Jesus Christ will not make you nice or orderly. It will make you a very poor citizen to the way things have always been. You will find yourself in the wasteland that is left after coercion and violence and fear have been uprooted. And it will be up to you and me, in the guidance of the Holy Spirit, to create the new world that we find there. I wonder if you remember these words spoken at the beginning of Luke's gospel. He has shown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud and the thoughts of their hearts. He has brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. He has filled the hungry with good things. He has sent the rich away empty. He has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy, according to the promises he made to our ancestor, to Abraham and his descendants forever. On Palm Sunday, the song of Mary comes to the streets. What is it that we have put our trust in? What is it that we rely upon to keep safe, to keep a kind of peace that steadies systems of injustice we have come to believe is in our best interest, in the interest of those we love? How has our acquiescence rationalized systems of oppression as health meats of the common good? These are the questions that confront every Christian who lives in the world, so it is a question for every one of us. Jesus comes riding on a donkey as the King of Peace. What are we willing to lay down before him? What chances are we willing to take, not on Jesus as a program for keeping things calm, but maybe opening up the world to something we cannot control? What will it take for us to trust that the order of creation is not upset in revolutionary violence, but in things dying and being raised to life again? What are you willing to be left undone in order to make space for resurrection? These are the questions of Holy Week, the questions that stretch out in time before us. And so I want to make an invitation to you. I'd like to welcome you into the story, to reenact it as part of this community. We'll gather on Thursday as Jesus gathered with his friends to eat. And then on Good Friday, we'll remember a love so perfect the world could not let it live. And then we'll gather on Sunday, the seismic shift in the death-dealing power, as we recall the resurrection of Jesus always unfolding here in the kingdom. Holy Week begins today. It begins with us becoming atheists to a belief in forms of security which we have been handed as control of human history. I want to end today, in just a minute, with you hearing a few words of the letter from the Birmingham jail from King himself. And after we hear Dr. King's words as our final meditation, I'd like to invite you to begin this week of reliving the story of Jesus by laying your branches here at the foot of the cross. As we lay down our beliefs in a system we believe will keep us safe and those we love. Let's see what will come of all of this.
Too long has our beloved Southland been bogged down in a tragic effort to live in monologue rather than dialogue. We know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. Frankly, I have yet to engage in a direct action campaign that was well timed in the view of those who have not suffered unduly from the disease of segregation. For years now, I have heard the word wait. It rings in the ear of every Negro with piercing familiarity. This wait has almost always meant never. We must come to see with one of our distinguished jurists that justice too long delayed is justice denied. We have waited for more than 340 years for our constitutional and God-given rights.